You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This is Kick-Ass News. I'm Ben Mathis. Why is it that comedy is just better in pairs? Abbott and Costello, Laurel and Hardy, Reiner and Brooks, Nichols and May, Key and Peele. And then there's my guest today, Middleditch and Schwartz. Both of them have achieved fame in their own right. Thomas Middleditch as Richard Hendricks on HBO's Silicon Valley, and Ben Schwartz as Jean-Raphael Saperstein on Parks and Rec. But when they get together on stage, something magical happens. Without so much as a script, an outline, or a single stage direction, these masters of improvisation play off of each other so seamlessly, both verbally and physically, and weave together a hilarious and nuanced 45-minute show completely out of thin air. To see Middleditch and Schwartz do improv is the comedic equivalent of seeing Muhammad Ali fight, Fred Astaire dance, or Pavarotti sing. And now, everyone can watch them do their thing in a new 3-part comedy special, Middleditch and Schwartz, now streaming on Netflix. And today, Ben and Thomas join me on the podcast to talk about their improv training at Second City and Upright Citizens Brigade, the fateful day they joined forces to become Middleditch and Schwartz, and why they still get a kick out of trying to make each other crack up on stage. They reveal what it's like to make up a 45-minute play as they go along, how they keep as many as 20 characters straight and even switch characters throughout a performance, and what happens when one of them ends the sketch, but the other one just keeps going on. Then we discuss how podcasts have kicked off an improv boom, what it's like to go from performing in small venues to 2,000-seat theaters, and the transition from doing a performance that exists entirely in the moment to recording them for all eternity for their new Netflix specials. Plus, Middleditch and Schwartz talk about their obsession with Daniel Day-Lewis, the night they played Carnegie Hall, and more. Coming up with Thomas Middleditch and Ben Schwartz in just a moment. Folks, you know Thomas Middleditch from his starring role on HBO's Silicon Valley and Ben Schwartz from his role as Jean-Raphael on Parks and Rec and most recently the Sonic Hedgehog movie. Now Thomas and Ben bring their two-person comedy show Middleditch and Schwartz to a global audience in a collection of 3 completely improvised Netflix comedy specials available starting April 21st. Middleditch and Schwartz, welcome.
Hey, hello, what's going on, man? How are you?
I'm good. I really enjoyed this, and I was honestly kind of surprised because, you know, I've been to a lot of bad improv, and so often it just seems very self-indulgent. I feel like I'm doing them a favor, straining to politely laugh. But with you guys, I got to say, the laughter was real. Just when I was starting to get jaded about improv, you pulled me back from the brink.
Oh, that's great. That makes us very happy.
Yes.
Well, I mean, you kind of get where I'm coming from, though, right? You know, so often it seems like every performer is just trying to shoehorn their own thing into that scene. It's very rare that you get two guys like you who actually are in sync and reading each other and genuinely playing off of each other. I mean, isn't that what improv is supposed to be?
Yeah, well, Sure. I think there's plenty of improv groups and shows that elevate it to a standard that you so desperately seek. I think what's interesting about improv, the mechanic of the community, is that there's very little delineation, maybe other than like the night that a particular show is on, between an incredible group and a group that's maybe, you know, just starting out, maybe just feeling it. You know, it's still the same ticket price typically. It's still the same like access. It would be cool if for some reason over time, maybe we help, maybe we don't, that some kind of a graduation into a more professional atmosphere can happen. Look, it's like only going to open mic stand-up shows. If that was your only exposure to it, you'd be like, oh, stand-up is so exhausting. But they have a structure in place where you can kind of graduate to new levels.
Yeah, and I mean, you guys are performing in big, like 2,000 seat venues and stuff. Usually it's in a small venue and it's like $5, $10 to get in. Is there a certain part of you that feels a little bit weird or guilty that you're charging what? Probably like $50 for improv?
Well, we made sure also throughout the whole thing that we don't outprice our fans either. We're not going places charging $70, $80.
Oh,
we're going places charging.
Okay.
If we play Radio City Music Hall, maybe. But I think Thomas is right that most people's example of improv has to be when they go to their friends' shows or something like that, because there haven't been specials yet. There've been maybe one or two. There's a TJ and Dave documentary, and those two guys are brilliant. Mm-hmm. There's like an ASCAT. There's a Showtime thing for House of Lies that I did, but there hasn't been like a real comedy special sent out in the same way that stand-up specials are.
Yeah.
And we're hoping that these Netflix things kind of do it. So you could see that there are a lot of great improvisers out there, which is exciting.
Let me ask you this. How long does it take for two people to become this in sync on stage? How many times would you guys say that you've performed together to get to this point?
I don't know the number of times. Somewhere in the hundreds.
Really?
And we've known each other. We've been performing together over 10 years. And separately, each of us have been doing improv on our own for 20 plus years.
No kidding.
I mean, I started in eighth grade, so... So it's not like we just started yesterday. This is like a thing that we've been like dedicating kind of our comedic lives to, and are finally getting a shot to take it to a grander audience.
And how did you two first meet? I mean, what's it like when you meet your improv soulmate? Is it love at first sight or what?
it was exactly that. I had found I found an ember, and inside of it was a big mosquito. And I had taken the DNA out of the mosquito and I put it into an embryo of a human being. And it just happened that embryo had frog DNA as well. And out came Thomas Middleditch, this beautiful boy.
And my first words were,
You didn't say the magic word. And so like we knew it. When we saw that, we're like, oh, we knew it. But we met when we were in New York doing UCB together, Chicago. Thomas came down from Chicago. And there was this system at UCB in New York that you had to kind of go through the classes to perform there. Mm-hmm. And Thomas had taken his classes in Chicago. And Thomas was obviously head and shoulders above, you know, almost everybody else at this theater. Well, when I saw him, I just thought he was so funny. Yeah. So we met together. We hung out in New York. We like ate pizza. There's a great Two Boots pizza experience with both of us. And then we started doing small shows like Wednesday at 11 p.m. for nobody at 8 minutes. Then we did 15-minute shows. Then we did 30-minute shows. And then it just started getting bigger and bigger. And you're right, though. There is a moment when you realize it really clicks. We're both friends, but we're not exactly the same person. We're different in some ways, and I think that only helps and elevates our improv.
Yeah, I knew that you were a UCB guy, Ben, but Thomas, I thought that you were a Second City guy.
Yeah, I did.
Or did you do both?
I cut my long form teeth in Chicago with Second City and Improv Olympic. Well, formerly Improv Olympic, now IO Chicago is what it's called. And yeah, I sort of like I performed at UCB, but with that sort of little rule in place, I was kind of stubborn. I had done all this training and I'd got to New York and they were like, you got to take classes. I'm like, I'm not doing a third school. It's just not happening. So I did improv with Ben and like weird cabaret shows by myself. And it was kind of a bizarre time in New York for me personally in comedy.
Is there a difference between the Second City versus the UCB styles that they teach? Do you ever find yourselves arguing technique?
Not arguing technique. We just kind of like blurred out our own business. But there definitely is, even between Second City and IO and IO and UCB, the schools of thought teach very similar fundamentals. Mm-hmm. But I would say Second City's approach to improv is it is a tool to get scripted material, to get a sketch comedy review show.
Okay.
And at the end, they will maybe do short form games as like a fun, like palate cleanser after their sketch show. IO, UCB, these places treat it like long form improv as like its own theatrical experience. And I would say IO is more like theater inspired. Okay. And UCB is more like, you know, get to the, you know, here's what's funny about it.
Thomas, would you say that our shows are kind of a mixture of both of those forms then? We never actually broke this down before.
It's a clash of two worlds, really. People are saying it. I just read a review that it said it's a clash of two worlds.
Clash of two worlds, wow.
That's a good title. It's interesting because I don't think that a lot of people, even people like myself who have seen improv, have seen long form improv. Usually, you know, mm-hmm. I'm used to going to a sketch show and maybe a sketch is 15 minutes. You guys go for 45 minutes, maybe even an hour. That has to really up the stakes for you guys.
Yeah, and also a lot of times when people have seen improv, they've seen Whose Line's It Anyway, which is something that Thomas and I grew up on and love. But that's short form, and it's like little games mostly. Mm-hmm. And then when you hit long form, you know, there are a series of different shows that we've all done. Many are like, you know, scenes that you're trying to like, you do a bunch of small scenes and try to call them back. But us doing this narrative, we really enjoy it because I think it does challenge us. It's not only just trying to make people laugh. It's trying to keep a story going, trying to keep all these characters in our head that we're switching off playing at any time. So I do really love that aspect of it.
Yeah, it's important to remember that like when improvisers talk about long form improv, it's more of just like a genre. Like what we do is like a type of executing long form improv. There are a million different ways to do it. I perform in a show that does it in a Shakespearean format or musicals, or as Ben was talking about ASCAT, which is like little scenes. There's just like so many different ways to do it. You can do it with two people, 8, 20, whatever. It's just... It's a genre. Well, we're not claiming to be the only people that do it this type of way either.
I have a question. How do you do musical improv? You just make up the lyrics and someone plays a tune?
We've both done musical improv. One of the first times I ever saw Thomas perform, I believe, was in a show called Baby Wants Candy, which is a Chicago show where they came to New York for Douglas Marathon, and it was amazing. I loved it.
Yeah, I mean, a show like that or a show like Diamond Wine, which this, which Eliza Skinner is very, very funny and talented, put together. Essentially, what we did, we'd get a title of like, what's a made-up musical? Here's some examples. Now you give us a title and then give it like, you know. Yeah, and then we'd start with an opening number and just try and do like cliche music stuff, and there'd be a piano or even like a full like 5-piece band, and then like they'd start up and we'd start singing. Yeah,
that's pretty amazing. What is your favorite made-up musical?
Oh man, it's been so long since
I rarely remember anything that I've done. I remember the biggest thing when I was doing long form or musical improv was, and I think Eliza was either in the group of me or was helping coach or whatever, but was like, you start to sing when there's a moment that words just can't express, and when you're like, get into song. Like, this is a moment that could be expressed in a song.
Yeah. I think Stephen Sondheim said that once. He said that you know when it's a musical moment when an emotion can't be expressed any other way. So that applies to improv as well. Huh? And it's interesting that, you know, here we are at a time when content is increasingly getting more and more short form. You took a short form art and did a long form version of it.
Well, I mean, we certainly didn't invent it, but it is nice that, like, we mentioned them before, this duo, TJ and Dave, they're out of Chicago. They're like legendary, legendary improvisers. Mm-hmm. They have a show, I think, that runs like 5 nights a week. They do a lot. But they do this, they do a patient sort of storytelling play, kind of like we're very inspired by them. Mm-hmm. And I love the idea of, like, especially in a comedy format, it's like, hey, sit down. We're going to tell you a little tale. It's going to be a little silly. We're going to have some laughs. But in the end, it's going to be a satisfying little, well, hopefully satisfying little story that we all listen to. It's not an hour and a half. It's under that. It's under an hour even. So it's not like crazy long, but that's kind of neat that you.
Yeah. Yeah. It reminds me a lot of the kind of riffing and improv that comedians like you guys do on podcasts like Comedy Bang Bang, almost more than the typical night at the UCB. Do you think that podcasts have been instrumental in popularizing improv with audiences who might not ordinarily think to go to an improv show?
I think that it's also
podcasts
like,
in general, just not this one, but yeah, definitely podcasts in general.
The idea of like Judd Apatow movies also and Adam McKay movies and stuff like that, introducing those type of people to, or you know, more the mainstream world, that is big. And then, but podcasts, I think like they're obviously, we're not doing like a long form improv show because there's aspects of it that are planned out. But it's, I think that Comedy Bang Bang is a good example of it. Improv for Humans is an improvised podcast, but I think Comedy Bang Bang being such a comedy milestone in the podcast world, I think makes it more accessible and also makes it so you can kind of be like, you see how people are making stuff up there? Well, these two guys get on stage and it's just them and they make up a whole whatever play together. Mm-hmm. So I think that's been helpful to point to, yeah.
And the other thing that stands out for me about what you guys do is I'm used to seeing improv shows with maybe 5 or 6 different people playing one, maybe 2 roles. I'm not used to seeing 2 guys playing all the parts and even switching roles at times. That was just amazing to me. I mean, what is the most number of characters that you guys have done in one show? Do you know?
Oh, Thomas, we did a Thanksgiving show once, Thomas. You remember that we were every family member around a Thanksgiving table?
Yeah, the Thanksgiving show where we established that we're like 20 people coming. And so at that one point, the guests came and we're like, all right, we got 20. Like, so each person will walk on like voice or stance or something. And then we're trying to remember everybody. I think sometimes like we set little challenges for ourselves like that, that are fun to see if we can like squirm our way out of the corner we taken ourselves into. Yeah. I think that's fun for the audience and it's fun for us. It's like a little game.
Yeah, I mean, when you go that long and have so many characters and build so many layers into a story the way you guys do, how do you keep all of that straight? I mean, it must be like having to keep up with a lie and then a lie on top of a lie and a lie on top of that lie.
Yeah, it's a bit like Trump.
It's like a lot of like little clues we'll give ourselves, like to remember a character, we'll give it a physical thing. Like there's one of the specials, a woman anytime before she talks plays her ponytail. So Thomas and I know that person is going to be that exact character or speaks with a certain cadence. But it's also the two of us are there. So if one person kind of forgets something, the hope is that the other person has enough of it to keep it going. And the other thing to remember is when we play in LA and when we tour sometimes, we'll do 2 shows in one night. So we'll make up a whole, and the shows when we do them live are 1.5 hours because we play with the audience a little bit more. Mm-hmm. So it's like doing 1.5 hour show, taking a 35, 45 minute break, and then doing 1.5 hour show. By the end, you're like very drained and, you know, we're sweating and we just want to go home.
Yeah, I can imagine.
I will say though, what I love performing about Ben is if need be, we kind of loosen up a little bit and be like, no, wait, hold on a minute. Let's just recap everyone who's in the room. Right. And there's a lot of, you know, there's pros and cons to that. One, we're like kind of breaking the fourth wall. Oh my God, sacred. No. But like another way of looking at it is it's just a comedy show. And if the audience is confused and they can see we're confused, then you start to see the gears gum up a little bit. And I've always thought like, no, let's just figure this out. Cause I won't be able to proceed if I don't know who's who.
Yeah. Yeah. And so that's some of the best comedy in it when you guys kind of get a little flummoxed or you can't remember who's who or what's going on. I love that stuff. But you play it off really well.
I think it shows the realism in it too. Yeah. It just like doubles down on that. We're making it up on the spot. Yeah. It like reminds you like, oh, okay. And also I remember there's a moment in one of the things where we're naming the characters and we forget one. And when we find out later, Thomas remembers, he's like, wait a second, this guy. And he makes that, which is great, is that in improv, there are no mistakes. So the mistake of forgetting him there, when we finally meet him, he's the one that fixes the whole show. You know what I mean? And has the next moment. But the audience also cheers because they're like, you forgot that person and now you got him. And now great. Now we're back on track. And stuff like that.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a great way to bring the audience in.
Yeah.
We're going to take a quick break and then I'll be back with more when we come back in just a minute. This ad is a warning. Our democracy is under attack from the U.S. Supreme Court. In the middle of a deadly global pandemic, people across Wisconsin were planning on voting absentee to keep themselves and their families safe. But the night before the election, 5 Republican justices on the Supreme Court told thousands of people
they would have to choose between risking their lives and forfeiting their right to vote. This Supreme Court favoring Republican interests over our democracy is nothing new. They gutted the Voting Rights Act. They invited billionaires and corporations to spend unlimited amounts trying to influence elections. They gave a green light to gerrymandering, voter ID laws, and voter roll purges. Now, a progressive movement is rising up to fight back, because it's quite possible the Wisconsin case won't be the last 2020 showdown over voting rights to be settled in the courts. And we simply can't trust this court to put aside partisan views and protect people's right to vote. Our courts are becoming too political. It's time to say enough. Learn more about how you can join the fight by visiting demandjustice.org/kick. That's demandjustice.org/kick. There's this one scene that I love in the first episode when, just so totally apropos of nothing, Thomas walks through a scene and is like, I'm a ghost.
Oh, yeah. Why did you do that, Thomas?
I was just walking across and you were like, and I was walking a certain way and you wanted me to be, I think, the best man guy. And I was like, no, I'm going to be this. It's just, it was like a jackass thing to do of being like, I don't want to do your idea. I'm doing this. And then you were like, what the hell? You know, it's, I was just being a prick, basically.
We mess with each other all the time, though. We'll do stuff like that all the time in shows because it's, we like to try to make each other laugh a lot.
Yeah, I was going to say, how much of the fun of it sometimes is just being able to throw something totally out of left field at the other guy just to see how he'll react or how he'll take that and then make something amazing out of that?
Well, I've said it before. I thrive off that audience laughter. I'm like a comedy vampire. I love it. But it's always a little private badge of honor when I can make Ben crack up. So it's a secret goal is to break him.
I think the goal is to try to break each other without breaking the show. So, you don't want to do something so insane that it derails the show. But if you see, like, a little nugget, we're like, I can get Thomas here. I'll get him real quick. And then we'll both play, and then we'll get back in. There's a great moment of rock, paper, scissors shoot in one of the episodes that when we were doing it, I was like, oh, this is so fun. It just turned into, we were playing two characters and all of a sudden we just turned into Thomas and I and had a conversation in the middle of a show, and it felt really fun, and it felt very much like one of our shows.
Yeah, and one of the most fun things for me is all the callbacks. I'm not used to so many callbacks in improv. Like, that's very stand-up.
Hey, man, if you make us perform for an hour, you know we're going to call some stuff back. We have so much stuff to call back.
Yeah.
It actually is like, yes, it's a challenge to like keep your filing cabinet open and store stuff away, but they end up being, those callbacks end up being the saving grace of the show. Like, you need them to close loopholes. You need them to get like laughs at the end. You need them to have your sort of story element feel satisfying, and the audience goes away being like, oh yeah, everything was concluded. Mm-hmm. So they're actually kind of like a requirement to long form improv. And to be honest, your saving grace, like you have to have them.
Yeah.
Yeah, and also just what amazes me is the physical choreography of what you do, and you know how you're able to physically manifest characters and situations. And I mean, you must have to be able to kind of read the other guy's kind of spatial scene that they're creating with the way that you move the chairs around and everything, or the way you play characters who have different heights off of each other.
Yeah, there's a lot of this is you're actively listening, always listening, and then also watching, and then just trusting. A lot of what we do is trusting the other person. No matter where we're going, the other person has our back, and we're going to create something together, even if it feels like we're going into a black hole that's going to give us nothing. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And everything the other guy does, or the other person, because everything that person does or says informs their character, your setting, your character, your relationship, and you have to be zeroed in onto that. It just, like, if you're elsewhere, there's nothing worse than being on stage and you're sending stuff out, dialogue, actions, and you feel like it's missing the other person.
Yeah.
You start to feel like, oh man, I can't build anything, and then you don't make a certain move, you don't say a certain thing because it won't land, and so then you go back to basics, and now you're just doing like, hi, I'm a doctor, hello, I'm a patient, and it just becomes this rudimentary thing. Like you have to pay attention to everything. It's very important.
It becomes also the idea that Thomas and I have spent so much time performing with each other that we really can, and like you could feel where people are going. It's like, I'm not comparing us to athletes at all, but it's like when you watch a great team
do.
Sport, if you watch, yeah, like Stockton and Malone, or Thomas will use an NHL reference. I don't know. Thomas, use an NHL reference of a great person.
Who says NCAA Oilers, baby.
There you go. So it's like the idea that what we like, we're always like, we played so much with each other that when we see someone doing something, we can kind of lean into it. Or we can kind of find each other. Mm-hmm. And I always love that idea.
Yeah, it seems like it really makes you more present, more aware, and kind of you have to get outside of your own head. Do you think improv has made you better at life?
I think it probably made us better at like talking to human beings and stuff, right? Yeah. I think it's helped business-wise, it helps you be a better writer, I think. Oh, yeah. I think it helps you be a better actor because half of acting is literally just reacting to what the person's saying. Mm-hmm. And if you're an improviser, you're trained to listen as hard as you can and have a natural reaction. So I think all that stuff, it is incredibly helpful for. But in real life, what do you think, Thomas? I think probably.
I think definitely. I'm about to get really hippie on you, but there is a philosophy, like kind of golden rule, a real in improv called yes and. It's like improv is so much philosophy and you just kind of take these sort of guidelines. But yes and means I agree to what you're saying or doing and I'm going to contribute to it. Mm-hmm. And thus a scene is born. But I think it can apply to a lot of elements of life. And yeah, not just, I mean, I know every comedian is supposed to be a snarky son of a gun and like a total sarcastic piece of shit, and I certainly am. But like, I think it's kind of a beautiful way to go through all the obstacles and bips and bops of the world. It is most of the time, if you can kind of like agree and contribute, you propel things forward.
Yeah, you know, maybe Donald Trump would benefit from improv. Do you think so? Or, I mean, everything is improv with him, though. I mean, he doesn't plan
Trump,
the next 5 seconds.
Man, do a 101, you know. Just,
that's going to be the title of this now, Thomas.
Trump should take an improv class.
Oh, boy.
Yeah, I have this thing where I always say that every person should do a 5-minute stand-up set at some point in their life, because in my mind, even though I've never actually manned up and done it myself, I feel like they'll learn something about themselves through the process and build confidence and humility and all this stuff. But now I'm thinking that of revising that. Maybe improv is a better idea at some point.
There's people that at the beginning of UCB in New York, that people would be taking improv classes to better themselves in whatever job they had.
Oh,
because
really?
They either were scared publicly speaking or being in groups or sharing stuff. And yeah. I remember people that weren't taking it just to become comedians. They were taking it because they wanted to try to get over some of their stuff. And it worked wonders. I remember at the very beginning.
Most people who take the class actually. Don't end up being like. I used early on in my improv world to make money as an improviser. You so rarely make money as an improviser by doing like improv on stage. So the first few gigs, many gigs actually, I had one in Chicago, was like teaching corporate improv, where it's like you'll go to an office, like some company's retreat, and you'll do trust games and zip zap zop and like basic scene work stuff, just to get people down with that philosophy of contribution, right? And collaboration. It's kind of, I do genuinely think it's a helpful thing.
Yeah, it sounds like some people treat it like Toastmasters, which I've never gone to Toastmasters, but somehow every city has a Toastmasters. And I always wonder who goes to those.
We heard about that in a show. Someone told us about Toastmasters in a show. We had never heard of it before. Then someone's like, yeah, it's like Toastmasters. Like, what? One of my friends, Sam Reich, who now I think runs all of College Humor, had this great line where he saw us on stage and he's like, oh, I got it. When you guys are on stage, it's meditation for you because you cannot think of anything but what's exactly happening in the moment. And I never thought about that before. And then I thought that was pretty accurate because we are truly not thinking about anything else but exactly what's happening.
Yeah, you do have to be so present. I know there's a lot of times where you'll come, I'll walk into the theater just before a show and maybe be down about life. You know, I do have a sad sack default setting. And show helps. Being in the moment, just creating some silliness, you snap out of it. You don't have time to think about all your other bullshit. And it's kind of a beautiful thing.
Now, like most improv, you get your ideas for the scene from the audience. But in your case, there's a lot more back and forth. You might do, say, 10, 15 minutes of crowd work, which can also be very funny. I'm curious, do you guys have any kind of a stand-up background?
I've done some stand-up. Yeah, I've done some stand-up. I have never been very good at crafting a joke.
Really?
Like, I've come up with some stuff that I thought was pretty good, and then, like,
oh yeah,
like, I'll go to a stand-up event, and it'll be, like, me and Kumail or something, and, like, I'll go up and be like, that went pretty well, and Kumail will go and just fucking destroy it. I'm like, oh, yeah. Oh, never mind. And I used to do, like, again, when I was in New York, like, before performing regularly with Ben and some other people, I would go to these cabaret spaces and do, like, character bits. It was very Kaufman-esque in the sense that I would alienate half the audience. But yeah, I recognize that I enjoy doing the odd bit of stand-up, and when I have material that I enjoy, I'll do it. But yeah, I can't claim to be very good at it.
I started off by freelancing for Letterman's Monologue, writing jokes for him, and then writing jokes for a Weekend Update. And then I tried by myself to do it, and I did, like, Boston Comedy Club in New York, and I probably went up 10 times, and I bombed once so hard that it made me feel so uncomfortable, and I was totally by myself, and I was taking UCB and stand-up at the same time. You know, I was doing stand-up and I was trying UCB at the same time, and I felt such a joy from doing the group aspect of improv, and I really connected with that I kind of, like, wanted to choose one, so I chose improv and sketch and went, like, full force into that. But stand-up is hard, man. Stand-up is an art. It is. You have to be very good at it to succeed. It is a very difficult thing.
Now, you guys, when you perform in L.A., I think that you usually go to the Largo, which is, that's a sort of a smaller venue than, you know, the kind of places that you're playing on the show. And improv in general tends to be a more intimate art form. How does it change things when you're now performing in these big, what, 2,000, 3,000 seat venues?
Not too much. I mean, nothing really. We really strive to do the exact same show that we would do for 100 people as we would for 3,000. It was our personal challenge when we started out touring of, like, we're not going to play, nothing against it, but we're not going to play, like, stand-up venues or rock venues. Nothing, again, nothing against it. We wanted, because it's a bit of a theatery type show, we wanted to play theaters, and we wanted to play big ones. We started out with 800-600 seat theaters, and then we got bigger and bigger. And it was a challenge not only for us to be like, are all our aspirations correct? Or is improv, like, relegated to these small black box spots? Like, who said that, by the way? Like, why do we think that? Like, why are we all these self-hating improvisers being like, we're not worthy. Only pay $5 to see us, man. We're sorry. Like, why is that part of the business model?
Right.
And so we were totally prepared to be proven wrong. In fact, like, the first tour, we were, like, so nervous that even if people came to see it, they'd be like, I couldn't understand anything or whatever, you know? But I don't know. Now we're on Netflix, so maybe there's some success in it.
Yeah, and you guys even played Carnegie Hall, I saw. Yeah. I mean, that sort of reminds me of a joke that Mulaney makes about only performing in these magnificent old theaters wherein the original owner would roll over in his grave if he knew he was playing there.
If the original owner saw a little bit that, like, that
show. Oh, my goodness.
It was a great, it was one of our favorite shows ever, but it was a little risque.
But by the way, the audience in New York loved it. And it's also that all the stuff that we were getting from the interview at the beginning lent itself to all of it.
Yeah.
But it is crazy for us to play those venues, to play Chicago Theater, to play Carnegie Hall, to play the Met in Philly. What we're trying to do is we're not trying to change what got us there. Mm-hmm. We're doing the same type of show that we would have done for UCB for, you know, nobody in the audience. And now later, that's why when we're touring, there was a fear of, like, what about these people who've never seen long form before? When we come on stage, how will they react? And it just happened to be that they got it and they love it. And it's connecting far more than we could have imagined.
Yeah.
These specials, even the reaction today, and the special's coming out. You know, Thomas and I are like, oh boy, what's going to happen? And then people have been so kind and supportive. And it's been a very cool day.
Was that your first time playing a venue built by a robber baron?
Is that true?
Andrew Carnegie.
Oh my goodness. No, we only perform in robber baron type venues.
It's just the Vanderbilts, the Carnegies, the Rockefellers, it's all the men who built America on Carnegie Halls. We're doing that tour.
Do you dress up for Carnegie Hall or do you wear what you wear in a regular
suit? Top hat, white gloves, the whole thing.
By the way, there's a funny story where we made these posters. Our friend Sella Shaloni, who's this great photographer, we did these posters for Carnegie Hall of us dressed in tuxes and we borrowed violins and we took pictures of us and just to be like, hey, we're playing Carnegie Hall. And like, that was the bit. So the poster in front of Carnegie Hall was that poster. We sold out, great. Which is insane. We get there for tech and we put our little microphones on. You know, we are a rinky dink operation. We bring our own mics like with us when we travel.
And when we warm up sound, it is like, we're yelling at each other, doing like beep, boop, boop. I like to pee in my mouth. La, la, la. Like it's nonsense.
Just to check the sound. It's insane. And then one of these old school guys who works in the back and, you know, like has been doing the sound there forever is like, hey, man, you can't wear that microphone because when you put your violin to your chin and you play, the microphone's going to get in the way. And we go, oh, no, no, no. Do you think we play the violin? And he goes, yeah, 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 yeah. And I go, oh, no, no, no. I don't think you're going to like this show.
And then we went on stage. He had witnessed the entire warm-up, the entire craziness, thinking that we are violin players.
Going up, 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 up. I take my own poop and throw it in the air.
What the fuck is this show? What are we doing here?
Yeah.
But I think we went afterwards and asked what he thought, and I think he dug it.
Yeah. He was like, Itzhak Perlman never would have done that.
But he did.
Yeah. I mean, usually when you do a show like this, it is something that entirely exists in the moment. In fact, I think you actually usually tell the audience that you're creating that show just for that audience only. But now that you've got a camera crew in the theater and it's being filmed to go out to millions of people on Netflix, do you suddenly start to think about blocking for the camera and, you know, can we make this joke? Folks in the heartland are going to light us up on Twitter. How does that change your calculus?
It's a great question. The couple things that when we're doing this special that we had to keep in mind that we didn't know about until literally, I think the day of the day before was we can't sing copywritten songs because we'd have to pay for it. And we don't have the money. We did not have a big budget on this. And we couldn't but I think the biggest thing for us was we've been doing it for 20 years each. We finally get this opportunity to do a special. We've done a bunch of great shows together and none of that matters. You only have four shots. We were filming four specials. We only get to cut one. So it's like, you cannot bomb these four shows because this is the representation of our careers in improv. So there was pressure in that. But I think Thomas and I are pretty good with that type of pressure because improv is basically all pressure situations. I'm sure we were both nervous because we wanted it to go well. It meant so much to us because we devoted so much of our lives to it. But it was that stuff. And yeah, you know, you don't want to. I think we've gotten very good at, you know, like we want to do what we do, but we don't want to like offend. Our goal is not to get on stage and offend people. Our goal is to make people laugh in the way that we make people laugh. I think we're pretty happy with the three that just happened to be the ones we did.
So you didn't find yourselves going back to watch it over and over again or being self-critical? Because, I mean, usually you do your show, you put it out there, and that's it. You're free of it.
Yeah, this is the first time we've watched our show. This is the first time
that
we've had to, like, put together an unedited version of it and sort of, you know, because you craft certain things in the edit of what camera to show and what second to trim. And it's pretty difficult for Ben and I in particular to not be extremely analytical. I mean, just without seeing it played back to us at the end of every show, we're kind of like, was that good? Like we have a little powwow of like, let's break it down, you know, because we both are perfectionists. We both want to do the best possible job. And that's honestly probably the biggest component that's propelled us to this level in improv is because you perform with a lot of people who are just kind of like, let's just go up there and do it. Who cares? And Ben and I are like, no, we're going to go up there and do the absolute best show we possibly can.
And if it feels a little off, we'll talk about it and what we could do better. Or, oh, that felt weird. Or da, 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 da. But then we'll learn from it and we'll move on.
One thing that occurred to me when I watched this is, how do you know when a sketch is over? Do you ever get a situation where one of you thinks that he's put a button on it and ended the show and then the other one keeps going?
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
That's happened.
Yeah. Of course. Because everyone's got their little files filed away in the filing cabinet and be like, no, there's this extra thing or what are you talking about? We finished it, you know, yeah. Whatever.
Encore.
Yeah, I mean, that happens. And it's part of the, I don't want to say the messiness, the spontaneousness of improv is just like, yeah.
Yeah.
I've also learned from doing a bunch of shows is that I rather call it a minute early as opposed to 6 minutes late.
Right.
Like
yeah.
if that great final line happened and we nail it and it's great, but if you go like five more minutes, people don't even remember that great line. They're like, oh, and then we end it with like, and that's our show and like stuff like that. So I think there is a lot of joy to figuring out. But we're pretty good at calling. Usually when one person calls it, the other person is on the same page, or we feel like this is the moment. It's been an hour and 15 minutes. Let's try to find that moment. And we kind of find that moment, and it's a great feeling.
Interesting is both Ben and I write. We write TV, we write film.
Yeah.
And not that you want to – no, neither of us are like wrestling the story part of our show because there is a narrative element. None of us are wrestling it this way or the other. We definitely pitch – and sort of be like, what about going this way? Okay, what about going this way? But as a result of all the writing and studying story structure and all this kind of like other background homework we've done, is we get a sense for like, oh, here at this point, you can introduce this element that will make the drama element more meaningful. Or right at the end, if this guy comes back in and says, everybody is under arrest, then that will make perfect sense. So it's nice to have that, like, save the cat.
Yeah. I'm completely amazed by that. I mean, the way that you guys, you know, you're writing a play as you go along. You got a beginning, middle, and end. And it just bowls me over how tight your improv is structurally. Well, before we go, I have to ask about this. I noticed that you guys dropped a There Will Be Blood reference into one of the episodes. And I read somewhere that you have a bit of an obsession with Daniel Day-Lewis. What is that about?
Oh, he's there's the greatest single living actor of all time.
He's incredible. Yeah. But there's this bit we did in Largo, which is the venue in LA, where we did it once or twice. Then we did it a bunch of times because it made us laugh. We would do this bit where we'd be like, okay, everybody, we heard that. By the way, everything is made up on the spot. This is just a bit that we did for probably 2-3 months.
Just to keep us smiling.
And also for the people who kept coming to the shows that thought it'd be a funny little thing. We'd be like, okay, we've taped off a seat for Daniel Day-Lewis. We do this every single show. We just heard that he's probably here. Sir, we would literally say, sir, we're not going to embarrass you. All we want is a hello. We'll just say hello to you. We'll count down from three. You say hello back. We won't bother you for the rest of the thing. You are our idol. Thank you so much. And I go, okay, ready? 3, 2, 1. And then there'd be everybody in the audience is so quiet because they think he's there and he doesn't say anything. Then Thomas and I go, what a fucking asshole. Why is it? And we'll go crazy.
We were secretly hoping that like word would get out and Daniel Day-Lewis would be like sitting there cobbling shoes in Italy, be like, huh, that would be pretty funny if I went to that improv show. I mean, it's insane. But DDL, you've got a comp if you ever need it.
Anytime you want to come to show. And also, can you imagine? By the way, we never really thought about like anybody could watch these specials now because they're worldwide. There's a chance that DDL watch the specials.
Yeah.
If he even has a Netflix subscription, I'll be blown away.
Yeah.
I would be blown away.
Yeah,
or
even
a TV or a laptop. I feel like I like.
Maybe you can get him on stage. Would you do an improv with DDL?
Absolutely
do anything that
not.
Guy wants always.
Yeah. No,
what, are you
way.
Crazy?
He hasn't
of
even
course.
Taken classes.
I drank your milkshake. See, every time I try to do Daniel Day-Lewis, I end up doing Bane from Batman.
Work on it.
Okay.
You were merely born from it.
Well, Middleditch and Schwartz is available on Netflix starting April 21st. Ben Schwartz and Thomas Middleditch. Thanks, guys. It was a blast.
Thanks, brother.
Thank you.
Thanks again to Ben Schwartz and Thomas Middleditch for coming on the show. Their 3-part comedy special, Middleditch and Schwartz, is now streaming on Netflix. For more fun stuff and information, visit MiddleditchandSchwartz.com. You can follow Thomas on Instagram at @TomBeanie and follow Ben on Twitter at @RejectedJokes or at RejectedJokes.com. If you enjoyed today's podcast, be sure to subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts and rate and review us while you're there. 5-star ratings and detailed reviews are one of the best ways for new listeners to discover the show. You can also follow us on Facebook or on Twitter at @KickAssNewsPod and recommend us to your friends on your social media. For more fun stuff, visit kickassnews.com, and I welcome your comments, questions, and suggestions at comments@kickassnews.com.
For now, I'm Ben Mathis, and thanks for listening to Kick-Ass News.